We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, June 27th, and the day that we have all been waiting for in the political world for the debate and the clash between Joe Biden and Donald Trump in this repeat of 2020. So we're going to get into all of that with some really good guests in the next couple of segments. But first, really big news yesterday out of the U.S. Supreme Court, and this coming from Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who has been a guest actually frequently on this show. He's one that you absolutely should follow on X for his analysis. He was one during the COVID pandemic that actually advised President Trump, he along with Dr. Scott Atlas, to say, hey, there is a different way besides some of these mandates and the closures. Unfortunately, they were overridden by Donald Trump and preferring the advice of Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx. And so Jay Bhattacharya was one that was actually censored by social media in the midst of his discussion and public commentary during the COVID pandemic. And that was what the case of Murthy versus Missouri was all about. So Jay posted this: the Supreme Court just ruled in the Murthy versus Missouri case that the Biden administration can coerce social media companies to censor and shadow ban people and posts it doesn't like. Congress will now need to act to enforce the Constitution since the Supreme Court won't. This now also becomes a key issue in the upcoming presidential election. Where do the candidates stand on social media censorship? We know where Biden stands since it's his lawyers that argue that he has near monarchical power over social media speech. The court ruled that the plaintiffs, Missouri and Louisiana, as well as me and other blacklisted individuals, lacked standing to sue. This means that the administration can censor ideas and no person will have standing to enforce the First Amendment. Free speech in America, for the moment, is dead. And since it was petty bureaucrats doing the censoring at the behest of elected officials, voters should ask every candidate for office down to dog catcher where they stand on the power of government to censor. Let's make it a political liability to favor censorship. I could not agree more. And Governor DeSantis posted this and actually quote posted Dr. Jay Bhattacharya in saying the court majority has rubber stamped a way for the federal government to censor speech that it doesn't like. The court is telling would-be censors, you can't directly censor speech, but if you pursue a sophisticated plan with enough subtlety, you can get away with doing it indirectly, what the Constitution clearly forbids you from doing directly. He's totally right. And this case ultimately boiled down to, I think, the majority, which was 6-3. And unfortunately, Justice Barrett was writing for the majority. So a Donald Trump nominee, and some of us, including myself, even at the time, had suggested and advised a different individuals. And, you know, I've been overall happy with Donald Trump's nominees. I mean, certainly better than, you know, what Biden would have put up or any other Democrat, certainly better than what Hillary Clinton would have put up, obviously. But they have been very disappointing. So it was only the minority, which included one of Trump's appointees, Justice Gorsuch, who I think is the best out of the three, far and away, even though, you know, he's had a couple of issues like the Bostock opinion and the reinventing of the word sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But, you know, we can quibble with everybody. And let's just be honest, nobody has been as good as the GOAT himself, Justice Thomas, who was also in the dissent in the minority. So it was Gorsuch, Thomas and Alito that were in the minority saying, hey, this is a big deal. We need to protect the First Amendment, which protects the right to publish, the right to speak freely, the right to participate in these social media platforms without censorship from the government. And it seems like with the majority kicking this out on the basis of standing, meaning that there's been no articulable harm, traceable or an injury in fact, to the plaintiff that's bringing the case. You have to have standing under Article 3, like, for example, which, of course, is the judiciary. So, for example, I can't bring a case as a plaintiff on behalf of someone else who has been injured. It has to be that person. The harm has to be traceable from the defendant to the alleged victim. And there are basically three prongs of standing in jurisprudential framework. But standing now has been a way for the Supreme Court and other courts, federal courts and state courts even, to just sidestep issues that they really don't want to rule on the merits. And this has been an increasingly, I think, overused way to simply just smokescreen this and sidestep, because you have not only states' attorneys general on that they can bring this on behalf of their own citizens, but also people like Dr. J, who himself was censored. So if someone who was censored can't challenge the person doing the censoring, which was the platform and the Biden administration, then who has standing? I mean, this is utterly preposterous that a 6-3 majority would actually suggest, you know, which of course included Roberts and the leftists, and sometimes he is a leftist, but also Barrett and Kavanaugh, right? To say that somehow these plaintiffs don't have standing to bring this civil suit. This is why I think that what Governor DeSantis posted was incredibly prescient and is right in terms of what the court is actually telling America. And so again, this is what he posted. The court majority has rubber stamped away for the federal government to censor speech that it doesn't like. The court is telling would-be censors, you can't directly censor speech, but if you pursue a sophisticated plan within a subtlety, you can get away with doing indirectly what the Constitution clearly forbids you from doing directly. And Jay Bhattacharya is right to say, well, you know, if people who are censored don't have standing, then who actually does? So it's going to be very interesting to see where this case goes from here, because what the court did in this case was say, you know, this kicked out based on standing, and so it's remanded back to the lower court. So there's some suggestion that maybe this may make its way back up because, you know, certain plaintiffs could be added. There could be additional challenges that are brought. But who, if not the individuals actually censored, would have standing? And the court in its majority, by suggesting that this was like far too attenuated, which is the legal term for saying, you know, it's kind of too remote, to suggest that the Biden administration was actually directing the social media platforms to censor. So, you know, there's not necessarily a traceable harm. And so traceability, you know, is also an issue of standing. Then Governor DeSantis is absolutely right that as long as you have enough middlemen, basically, and you have a sophisticated enough plan, then you can circumvent the standing issue and just carry on with whatever the government would like to do. So this is basically telling the Biden administration, go ahead and tell social media companies what you want them to do. And this would apply anywhere, not just to social media companies, but, you know, imagine if the government was somehow now suggesting that other private individuals need to bring other types of lawfare, for example, against conservatives, or it's directing some other private entity to go after conservatives, either in censorship or in foreclosing any of our other highly cherished first freedoms, which of course are freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of the press, and freedom, of course, free exercise of religion and freedom of association. I mean, these are things. And then, of course, right to redress. I think I said association twice because I'm so jazzed up on coffee right now because I'm really mad and you should be too. But all of those first freedoms, imagine if the Biden administration now, or any other Democrat administration, even on the state level, wants to foreclose or infringe upon any of those freedoms that the Constitution specifically forbids, and they just get a middleman. I mean, this is classic agency law, where the government has used, in the context of criminal law, for example, confidential informants. They become agents of the government for purposes of their informing, because, you know, they, if they wear a wire, you know, some of these things, and those informants or those agents of the government, even if they're not actually paid, they're not employed by, they have an agency derivative, and they still have to comply with all of the due process protections that the Constitution provides, because they are acting at the behest of government. I mean, this is classic black letter law and precedent that we have had since the inception of the Bill of Rights. I mean, and the whole design of limited powers of the government. The whole foundation of our Constitution is built on this. Isn't just a First Amendment case. This goes to the heart and soul of our separation of powers, but also the limited textual authority that is given to government. Because if government is so unlimited that it can just put up a smokescreen and can say to any private entity or private actor or agent that it wants, hey, you go do a thing. We're highly encouraging. We're not directing you. You know, there's not really traceability here. We're like, we're not going to give anybody standing. We're just going to like strongly encourage you to go and do what we can't. Then government, by virtue of this private actor shield, essentially, that the Supreme Court has now licensed, then the government's power is virtually unlimited. That is not what our founders intended. What our founders intended, and what we actually celebrate in just a couple of days next week on July 4th, is our great declaration. Because remember, before the words, we the people, there were three really important words. This unanimous declaration. The Declaration of Independence was the worldview framework of what our founders understood had to be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, for liberty's interest. That it was not monarchs that reign by right of conquest or by birth, that they didn't just come into this inheritance of power, but that we the people could select and prefer our leaders to occupy offices in the federal government, the republic that was then established later in 1787, and we celebrate Constitution Day in September. And then, of course, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, were ratified by the states at a later time, but they're part and parcel to the U.S. Constitution, which are entire 27 times that we've amended the Constitution in our nation's history. That has become the highest law of the land. And what our founders understood, and the worldview mandate that they put out in the Declaration of Independence, was that they understood how a government so unrestrained by a separation of powers, by not understanding that our rights are given by God, our creator, that are pre-political, we possess them as human beings made in the image of God before any government is ever coming into the process. Just by virtue of our humanity, we have certain unalienable rights from natural law that are God-given, that then it's the sole legitimate purpose of government to preserve and protect those rights. And then, of course, at the Constitutional Convention, they debated all, you know, about how we should actually protect those rights, and we came up with a constitutional republic as our design. And as I've said many, many times on this show, that's not necessarily the only form of government that's legitimate. Our founders could have created all kinds of different governments, and we in America tend to think, as sort of an a priori assertion, that a constitutional republic is the most legitimate form because that's what we're used to here in America. I would say that we got it right in that sense, but as our founders understood, our Constitution and limiting the powers of government is only good for a moral and upright people. It's wholly inadequate for the government of any other. Why? Because we have to have self-restraint if we are in a self-governing society. And if our judicial branch, which is the independent branch that is mandated to rein in the political branches, are unwilling to do that because of, you know, whatever their rationale was, which I think was just political cowardice on the part of the majority, probably in the leftist and those jurists, it was something else. You know, they want censorship. They want this Democrat liberal utopia that ultimately goes to a one world government. But if our judicial branch is unwilling to restrain the two political branches, then our system collapses. And we need to do better as conservatives to conserve our constitutional republic. And we need to be praying for this country, because this decision will have much broader impacts than just on the First Amendment. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning for more discussion, more debate and analysis, of course, of the debate coming up tonight. So we'll be right back with more. This June marks 2 years since the overturn of Roe v. Wade. But did you know that the number of abortions actually increased in the following year? In 2023, the amount of abortions reached its highest level since 2012. Preborn continues to stand strong for women in crisis. Preborn is a ministry of compassion that showers women and babies with God's love, providing free ultrasounds to mothers to introduce them to the precious life growing inside of them. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and $140 helps to rescue 5 babies. Your generous tax-deductible donation will also help to provide women who choose life with assistance for up to 2 years. So please give your best gift. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And we've been talking about the Murphy versus Missouri case. It was just such a disappointing opinion from the 6-3 majority. And so let's welcome in now Josh Hammer, who is my very special guest this morning, friend of the show. He is a senior editor at large at Newsweek and the host of the widely listened to, very popular, The Josh Hammer Show, and is also an attorney, was a former law clerk for the Fifth Circuit. So I always read everything that he writes about legal opinions, and you should too as well. Even if you sometimes disagree, occasionally we disagree, but it's always worth reading to have a very informed opinion. So Josh, good morning.
Good morning, Jenna. Always a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, thanks. So so before we get into the debate analysis, and I'm really looking forward to your opinions on that, let's talk about Murphy. And what did you think of this 6-3 opinion?
It's a devastating opinion. It's horrible. You know, this has been one of the more under-discussed cases on the Supreme Court docket this year. I think conservatives have not been properly focused on this particular case, and that's really a shame, because we're dealing here with one of the most devastating issues of our time, which is the insidious fusion of state and corporate power. You know, back in the day when I was in high school, when I was reading about history and political theory, you know, we had a name for the fusion of state corporate power. That name was fascism. And it's not a terribly far stretch from that to what has been happening here with the Biden administration dictating to the social media platforms to suppress speech, that is contrary to the regime-approved narrative when it comes to COVID-19, when it comes to vaccinations and masking, when it comes to the 2020 election, when it comes to the Hunter Biden laptop. We saw this with the Twitter files when Elon Musk took over there. So we have seen a sprawling censorship industrial complex. And to see the Supreme Court essentially punt on this rather than to reaffirm our First Amendment rights is really horrific. And it goes against the Supreme Court's own precedents. The court said 50 years ago in a case from 1973 called Norwood versus Harrison, they said the government, quote, may not induce, encourage, or promote private persons to accomplish what it is constitutionally forbidden to accomplish itself. Yet that is literally exactly what happened in the Murphy versus Missouri opinion. It is a devastating outcome for free speech. The evidence in the evidentiary record was absolutely overwhelming. It led the district judge in Louisiana, Terry Doty, who presided over this case. He issued his sprawling preliminary injunction last year on July 4th. He called it the greatest attempt at censorship in the history of the United States. He used the term Orwellian to describe what the government was doing. And for this putatively conservative Supreme Court to just simply punt on this is pretty inexcusable, I think, Jenna.
I completely agree with you. And They punted on the issue of standing, and people like Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, I was talking about this in the last segment, were actually censored, who were plaintiffs in this case. So if somebody like him does not have standing, I mean, who does?
You're asking the right question. I mean, I guess they're saying that the individual's names didn't appear often enough in the evidentiary track record, but it's crazy. It's really crazy. I mean, we saw, thanks to discovery in the litigation, we saw the frequency with which Jen Psaki from the White House podium and all the other various actors in the Biden administration, everyone from HHS to the FBI to other agencies, we saw the frequency with which they were communicating with Mark Zuckerberg and Meta, with Jack Dorsey, the former head of Twitter, and the various other big tech oligarchs, and we saw repeatedly how they actually named individual accounts that they wished to either be shadow banned or outright banned, kicked off the platform in its entirety. People like Alex Berenson, who was definitely not abiding by the regime approved orthodoxy when it came to COVID-19. So I don't know, Jenna, but one thing that I do know is that the liberal justices in particular on the Supreme Court are certainly not even close to intellectually consistent when it comes to standing doctrine. So one thing that I kind of was thinking about when I read the opinion was I was thinking back to the 2007 case of Massachusetts versus EPA at the U.S. Supreme Court, which is another standing threshold case where the Commonwealth of Massachusetts essentially sued the EPA, the Bush-era EPA, for certain environmental regulations, and their theory of standing for the entire state was that they didn't want the receding shoreline in Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard. And back then, the liberal justices, along with Anthony Kennedy and some moderates, they were all too willing and eager to grant this extraordinarily liberal, dubious view of standing. So it's funny how inconsistent the liberal justices in particular are when it comes to standing doctrine here. So it's just a total mess from top to bottom. Hopefully another plaintiff will try to give it a go and that we'll get a ruling on the merits here in the next year or two. But for now, it is nothing less than a tragic outcome for the First Amendment.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And for Barrett and Kavanaugh to be in this majority, I mean, I could have seen this being 5-4 with, like, you know, Roberts and the liberals being in the minority here and being pro, let's skirt this issue. But for Barrett to actually write the opinion and then Kavanaugh to join, that doesn't really signal much confidence in the overall originalist view of the court.
So the dirty little secret, Jenna, and I suspect that I'm preaching to the choir here, but the dirty little secret of the Trump administration when it comes to the Supreme Court is that while all of the picks are obviously better than liberals, and they obviously were all on the correct side when it came to the most important case of the past 5 years, the Dobbs case that overturned Roe versus Wade. But the dirty little secret beyond that is that none of them are actually really rock-ribbed, consistent conservatives, consistent originalists. Far from it. On the current U.S. Supreme Court, as I have been saying for years, my friend Josh Blackman, the law professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston, he's been saying it for years. There have been a few of us, only a few of us, but we have basically been shouting this from the rafters that in any given case or controversy before the Supreme Court, there's actually only two conservative justices that you can always count on, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. That is really it. Neil Gorsuch is correct more often than he is not correct. He is the best of the three Trump nominees, but he has an idiosyncratic libertarian streak. We all remember the Bostock transgender case in 2020. He's the single most liberal justice on the entire court when it comes to Indian tribal issues. He goes soft on due process, immigration, deportation stuff. And then you have Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. Brett Kavanaugh is a Bush Republican. He's basically Karl Rove in a robe. That's essentially how I would describe him. Amy Coney Barrett, I don't really know what to say about her. She just seems to be timid. She didn't really have a tremendous track record, frankly, when she was tapped for the Supreme Court. And if I'm being brutally honest, back when she was a law professor at Notre Dame Law School, she didn't have a particularly long and impressive track record of legal scholarship either. So I don't really know what to make of her, but she's certainly not doing exactly a bang-up job at this point, I think we can all say.
Yeah, unfortunately. And it's so sad because we had three opportunities as conservatives under the Trump administration to get really solid jurists. And imagine if we had a consistent, you know, Alito, Thomas mold of five. I mean, that would just be so solid for the Constitution. And there would be nothing that the liberal or weak-minded could do about it. And we would have a really solid judicial branch and the rogue justices sitting on the court. So let's talk about the Trump administration and a potential second term. Likely there will be one or more appointments for whomever is president in this next term. Looking forward to the debate tonight. Do you think that the judiciary is going to come up? Because Trump made that a key voting issue in the wake of Scalia's passing and that open seat in 2016. I think he should make that a much bigger issue than his campaign currently has heading into 2024.
Well, I suspect that the judiciary will come up in the abortion context, if nothing else. I mean, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have basically nothing else to run on, Jenna. They have no economic track record. I mean, it's a terrible record, if there's any record there. Obviously, the southern border, the immigration issue, which is a top concern for voters. I mean, to call it disastrous would be an understatement. When it comes to foreign policy and the world stage, the whole world is on fire right now. There are wars raging on multiple continents. God knows what's going to happen with China. Now they're sparring with the Philippines. I mean, the whole world is a mess. So the only issue that Joe Biden is basically running on is essentially to fearmonger on the abortion issue. Now, that probably is the context in which the Dobbs case will come up. And I expect Donald Trump to have no other choice but to defend the Dobbs ruling. The problem, Jenna, is that Donald Trump is now sounding a lot like Stephen Douglas. He's now sounding a lot like a states' rights absolutist when it comes to the abortion issue. And, you know, perhaps that is politically prudential and necessary for the time being, but, you know, it is certainly not the correct outcome in the long term, let alone what the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause actually requires, as I have been arguing in recent years. I've argued that the Equal Protection Clause actually requires that all human beings not have their their right to life arbitrarily taken away from them, and that they all have equal protection of the laws. So, you know, I will be interested to hear what the president has to say, because he's trying really, really hard to avoid the abortion issue. But, you know, when you come back with kind of one hand tied behind your back and they're coming at you with everything you've got, and ultimately you're probably going to lose that exchange, sadly.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right that the Biden-Harris campaign has been pushing the abortion issue because they have nothing else to run on. I mean, all of their ads on social media, on television and media have been really hitting the abortion issue hard. And so there is this question as well, if Trump is going to unveil his vice presidential pick at the debate. I think that's probably unlikely. And I say that and then it'll probably happen, but only because Trump likes to be the center of attention. But at the same time, that would make his campaign the center of attention. But in terms of the VP, I think it would be a very wise choice to pick someone like a Sarah Sanders, who is a mom herself, very ardently pro-life, very pro-conservative Christian, you know, all of those things that can directly combat the whole leftist abortion narrative in a way that, you know, someone like a Marco Rubio or even a, you know, Governor Burgum or a J.D. Vance could not do nearly as effectively.
So I like Governor Huckabee Sanders. She would be my top choice among all the female candidates who are in it. I happen to like her a lot. I think she's a very good governor. But my actual top pick, and, you know, Jenna, you're not going to agree with me on this, which is fine. That's your prerogative. But, you know, my actual choice, which I've been pushing for months now, is J.D. Vance. And I'll explain to you why. Because if I'm looking at the actual Electoral College map, Donald Trump's in very good shape in the Sun Belt states. He's up by 4 or 5 in Nevada. He's up in Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, you know, to say nothing of Texas and Florida, of course. So he's crushing it down there in all the Sun Belt states. The problem, from a math perspective, is that even if you win all those states I just mentioned, unless you can peel off an unexpected state like a Virginia or a New Hampshire, you're going to have to win at least one of those three blue wall Rust Belt states that he won in 2016. That's Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. You're going to have to win at least one of those three. And just looking at the crass mathematics of it, the race to 270, if you will, there's no candidate who I think can better help Donald Trump do that than the young, precocious senator from Ohio, the guy who literally wrote the book Hillbilly Elegy. He speaks those voters' languages more than any elected official in America right now. I think it's also a really nice generational contrast. He's so young. He's much more in touch with younger voters at a time when the Republican ticket is making dramatic inroads among millennial and Gen Z voters. They're starting to peel away from the Democratic ticket. So that is definitely who I would encourage the president to select if I were in the room with him. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I happen to like her a lot. She probably is my second choice. So we're not that far apart, Jenna.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, I agree with you. And Sarah Sanders, Governor Sanders, is absolutely my first choice for a lot of reasons. I also think she was a great spokesperson on behalf of Trump, and he clearly values that. For all of those, you know, as you rightly describe it, crass mathematical reasons, Vance would be a good pick. I'm not so convinced that if for any reason the vice president would have to take over the responsibilities as president, J.D. Vance is who we would want in office. And I just have some, you know, concerns along those lines. But ultimately, I think that Trump is very pragmatic in a lot of his choices. And he clearly has a lot of acolytes to pick from. People who are singing his praises will be very good spokespeople. And you know, Vance and Sanders and among others are, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy even, you know, has been in the mix. And so looking at all of the options, I think he's going to go with someone who adds votes and states, because all that this comes down to is electoral math. Because if he doesn't win, then of course his VP isn't going to matter anyway. And anybody that he selects, including Vance, so I'll give you this, anybody is better than Kamala Harris. Like, I cannot, I just can't with her. And
no
and,
doubt about that.
Yeah, and the cackle and the ridiculousness. I just want to see a vice presidential pick be able to meet the abortion issue with a lot more strength than currently President Trump has, which is unfortunate. But in just the last couple of minutes we have with you, Josh Hammer, and really appreciate it. Everyone should follow Josh on social media, read everything he writes in Newsweek. Again, because, you know, even if you disagree on certain issues like Josh and I just did, his rationale is very sound and should always be read, because you've persuaded me on a lot of different topics that initially we disagreed on. But so just in the last 2 minutes, what do you expect from the debate tonight? Because the rules of CNN are, you know, a lot different than the debates last time. There's not going to be as much talking over each other, probably. So what should viewers be watching out for?
Well, the first and most obvious thing to watch out for is how the moderators comport themselves. Now, look, the Trump campaign agreed to this debate, so the constant bashing of Jake Tapper has been a little over the top. That's not to say that Jake Tapper is not biased; he obviously is. But again, the Trump campaign did agree to this debate, and you guys knew what you were signing up for. On the other hand, I think the viewers should definitely be watching carefully to see whether they act with something resembling impartiality or fairness, or whether or not one of them starts to lose it on Donald Trump. Now, the main thing substantively to look out for, because the moderators, I suspect, will try to trip up Donald Trump on this, will they do the 2020 relitigation, or will they let him talk about a forward-facing agenda? That's the big question.
Yeah, and that will actually be one of those things that Trump will have to resist the urge to go that direction and be forward-facing, because I think that's going to win him a lot more of the independents, moderates, and disaffected Republicans that don't want to relitigate all of that. So Josh Hammer, really appreciate your analysis as always. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Here's a chance for a trip full of great memories with AFA at the Ark. Join Wesley Wildman and Tony Battagliano for a special trip to the Ark Encounter in the Creation Museum October 31st through November 2nd. Enjoy tours, activities, and special presentations, and join a panel discussion with Wesley and Tony. Space is limited, so visit afa.net/events and click AFA at the Ark to find out more and register. That's afa.net/events and click AFA at the Ark. Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
I think I've been preparing for court for my whole life, if you want to know the truth. And I'm not sure you can lock yourself into a room for 2 weeks or 1 week or 2 days and really learn what you have to know. And I've been through it. I've been, you know, a popular president. We had some great elections and some amazing, you know, number of votes. Nobody got more than we got. And, you know, I know the subject. Now, you know, they make it cute because it's obviously at CNN, and I call it fake news for a long time. We'll see how they do it. I think they have a lot at stake, to be fair. I think they have to be fair. But we'll see how we do. I think we'll do very well. We've done well in the past, and I think we'll do very well. I know the subject matter. But I don't think, Corey, you can just lock yourself in a room like some people do and think you're going to come out okay. It doesn't seem to work that way.
That was Donald Trump talking on Newsmax about his view of debate prep. And of course, Joe Biden is the one that is locking himself in a basement, likely for the week. He will not be seen at the White House leading, you know, a lot of conspiracy theorists to conjecture, you know, will there be like a replacement candidate, you know, all of that. But Biden, with his obvious cognitive decline issues, may need to brush up on things like, you know, national security and I don't know, like, you are the president right now, where the Oval Office is, where the bathroom is. I don't know. But let's welcome in Jeff Hunt, who is a good friend, and he is the host of the Jeff and Bill Show on 710 KUNS Salem Media Denver, if you are listening from the Denver area. Jeff is on from, I believe it's 6 to 10 Mountain Time. So yes, Jeff is not one of those that can be two places at once. So we are pre-recording this segment because I really wanted his analysis on. So thank you, Jeff. Thanks so much for joining today.
Jenna, always great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. So your thoughts overall on the debate and Donald Trump, you know, getting that jab in at Joe Biden, even ahead of the debate clash.
Yeah, you know, I was in the room when Mitt Romney debated Barack Obama the very first time. It was at the University of Denver. And so there's some things that you can learn that are pretty interesting. So first of all, the president is not used to debating. And so the challenger in this case, Donald Trump, has a unique advantage because, you know, the president's not normally on stage. And particularly this president is not on stage taking hard questions from the media really ever. So Joe Biden has got to put himself in a position that he really hasn't been in for the last 4 years, which is willing to go toe-to-toe intellectually with an adversary. I don't think it's going to work out that well for him. But here's my big concern. I think we do this constantly as Republicans, is set the bar too low with Joe Biden. We do this with the State of the Union all the time, too. We're like, oh, the guy needs to be propped up, or the guy needs to be shot with a drug or whatever. And then he comes out and he does just fine. I think Donald Trump's got to take Joe Biden very seriously. Look, he's got to where he is, not because he's a dope, but because he's very strategic and very savvy, and he's smart. So Joe Biden is going to be a formidable opponent on this debate, and he's got to be ready to go toe-to-toe with him on serious policy issues. But also, listen, Jenna, there's plenty of, you know, debates out there over policy that people can tune into. It's called C-SPAN, and it's boring. Nobody wants to watch just a discussion on debt issues or foreign policy issues. We want to see that entertainment side of Donald Trump come out. Ronald Reagan was so good at this. Donald Trump has been going to these MMA fights for the past few years to showcase he is a fighter. He needs to walk out of that tunnel like it's an MMA fight, and he's ready to go to battle against Joe Biden, the corrupt uniparty for America's founding principles. So in addition to taking Joe Biden seriously and in addition to engaging on policy, he's got to be entertaining and fun, because you're going to have 70 million plus people watching this debate. It can't just be a policy discussion like you see on C-SPAN.
Yeah. And, you know, Jeff, it's so funny that you say that, because I was actually talking yesterday about this book that I'm rereading, which is called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. And he actually harkened back to the Reagan era. I mean, this was written in 1985, but saying basically how our discussions around policy and philosophy and theology, all of these things, have become so entertainment driven in a television media culture that we have come to expect that not only from our churches, but also from our politicians. And I think that's absolutely true, that as much as we can talk about that and maybe be sad about that, quite frankly, that is the world that we live in. And there's nobody better than Donald Trump that has made entertainment translate incredibly well on an entertainment-driven platform like a debate stage. And so I would love to see him come out and pack that punch and have some very quick one-liners, but also get into some points of why the Biden administration has been so terrible. And so how can he kind of walk that line between the entertainment value, which is what everybody loved in 2016. I remember, well, because you'd be in jail, you know, that whole thing against Hillary, it was just that ended her, right? And do those kinds of things, but without then what he did in 2020, which was just talking over the moderator, talking over Biden, and it didn't really go over well in that debate.
Yeah, you know, you talk about television brain. We're at TikTok brain now. We've gone from 30-minute shows to 30-second clips that we watch on our phones. And I would love the American electorate to be able to read the Federalist Papers and dive into constitutional theory, but they can hardly even put together the idea that we have three branches of government. So it's part of our education system. I blame them. I blame our government-run schools. So one of the things that Donald Trump could do that's very unique in this particular cycle is he doesn't have to defend his record like Joe Biden does. Joe Biden's got to defend what he's done for the last 4 years. And if Joe Biden's really struggling cognitively, putting together sentences, making arguments, well, you could just let the guy talk. You know, we all know this because, Jenna, you engaged in debate. I engaged in debate, too. When your opponent is really failing, you just let them continue to talk. You don't need to jump in and try to prove it. So Donald Trump can just let Joe Biden go about his ways, trying to explain why inflation's so high, why it's so hard to buy a house right now, why we're in all these foreign wars. Please, Joe, you've had 4 years. Share with the American people how you got to us to where we are right now and the disasters we're facing in this country. I'm just going to sit here and be quiet and watch Joe stumble through his answers. And, you know, Donald Trump may not have to do too much at that point.
Yeah, well, and that's great advice, actually, to just, you know, let Biden kind of hang himself in that. And it was funny, our friend Kevin Sorbo posted this on social media, presidential debate prediction. Mr. Trump, tell us about how evil you are, and you have 1 second to respond. Biden, tell us about why you're just so amazing and why everyone loves you, and you have unlimited time to respond. And I think that's a pretty apt prediction, because this is CNN. I mean, they're not going to be unbiased. This is a forum that they have so catered around trying to prop up Biden. Have we really lowered the threshold of what it would take for the media to claim a Biden win? I mean, they're going to the leftist media is going to do that regardless. But if Biden just stands up and is remotely coherent, is that all that he has to do to be declared the winner?
You know, that's one of my concerns, but I have a few other things that could happen at this debate that we need to keep in mind, too. One, it might be the best thing for Robert F. Kennedy that he's not on the debate stage. So one scenario is these two old dudes go at it so viciously and are so out of tune and out of touch with the American people that that everyone watching the debate on Thursday night goes, well, is there anybody else out there? and they're looking at maybe Robert F. Kennedy as an alternative, and the guy was never even on the stage. So that's one way. But, yeah, you're right. The media is going to claim victory. And one of the realities, you know this, Jenna, with some of the hostile media we face here in Denver, is that if you're a candidate, particularly if you're a Republican candidate, you not only have to debate your opponent, you have to debate the moderators as well. And that's just not fair, but it's the reality that we live in, and that pushes the Republican candidates to have to perform that much better. It's one against two in that debate, and that's just the way our media works, and you've seen that with Jake Tapper and the other co-host, Dana Bash. They are not fans of Trump, and he's got to go in there and take them all on at once.
And Jeff, I did not cut off your mic or end the segment because you mentioned, you know, Jake Tapper and Dana Bash unfavorably, unlike what CNN did to Trump's spokesperson the other day, which I thought was so ridiculous. I mean, she wasn't actually being disrespectful at all. She was simply pointing out that, no, these activists are not these unbiased, unopinionated individuals. I mean, they're literally hired by CNN for their opinions. I mean, that would be like saying that I'm an unbiased journalist. No, I'm hired by AFR specifically because I am a Christian, I am a conservative, and that is the worldview that you are going to get from this show. And we need to be a little more open about that, that there are some actual reporters out there, very few. I think John Solomon is a great example of one that I still really respect in Washington, but I could name, like, you know, on one hand. But speaking of Kennedy, it is really interesting. I think he should have been on the debate stage. If we were in the roles of Ross Perot in 1992, he would be on the stage, but he's going to stream on X and at therealdebate.com during the debate. This is what he had to say about it.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. here. Over 70% of Americans want a different choice than Presidents Biden or Trump. They're tired of voting for the lesser of two evils. Presidents Trump and Biden colluded with CNN to block me from representing your voices, but I'm not going to let them silence us. Go to therealdebate.com to watch me answer the same debate questions live. I'm going to be on that debate stage with or without their permission. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and I approve this message.
That's a really interesting tactic, and, you know, more power to him, because I want to see him answer those questions, and he's going to do it live so that there's no, you know, more prep time, and they, you know, people can't, the two campaigns can't say that. Do you think that that will have any impact, or are people going to be so focused on the potential, you know, mudslinging between Trump and Biden that they're not going to pay as much attention?
Well, you know, Robert F. Kennedy said over 70% of people want alternative candidates. The problem Robert F. Kennedy has is that over 70% of people don't want to listen to his voice. I'm sorry. I know I sound really shallow, but politics is really shallow sometimes, and they don't want to listen to that voice. So look, it's not his fault. It's a physical deformity that he has. There's nothing he could do about it. I think that he's brilliant. I would have loved to have heard his ideas, but he's just going to run into just a hard brick wall of reality that he, that scratchy voice that he has, people don't want to hear. But I'd like to hear his ideas. I think it's a shame he's not on the stage. I think this is all proves it's kind of a uniparty in this country that, you know, wants to keep it between two old guys that 70% of people would rather have alternatives with. So it's disheartening. And to his credit, Robert F. Kennedy is putting these documentaries out that are actually pretty interesting and compelling. He did one recently on fentanyl and drug overdoses. He's addressed his critics head on, talked about his background and his bio. I've all found that really interesting and compelling. I like him. Man, if he was able to communicate in the same way his uncle and his father could, I think he has a real shot. Maybe there's somebody else in the Kennedy family that can do it. But at the end of the day, I mean, you heard that. It's just hard to imagine listening to that as the leader of the free world for 4 years. I sound shallow, but it's just part of the reality that's going to stop him from being successful.
It is. And, you know, going back to Neil Postman and amusing ourselves to death, I mean, that's a point that he makes where he says this, you know, although the Constitution makes no mention of it, it would appear that fat people are now effectively excluded from running for high political office, probably bald people as well. Almost certainly those whose looks are not significantly enhanced by the cosmetician's art. I mean, we remember the Kennedy debate, right, with Nixon, where he decided to wear makeup on TV. Nixon didn't. Yep. That was a huge indicator, right? And so Postman says, indeed, we may have reached the point where cosmetics have replaced ideology as the field of expertise over which a politician must have competent control. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it is very shallow, but in this optics-driven world, this is what made Donald Trump so successful, is he is a master of media. And so in just the last about 2 minutes we have with you, Jeff Hunt, and everyone should follow Jeff Hunt on social media, at Jeff Hunt, and listen on 710 KNUS. What does Trump need to do then if the bar is so low for Biden? And, you know, we'll talk, we talked about RFK. What does Trump have to do for at least the Republicans, independents, moderates, for him to be declared the winner in those voters' minds?
One word, strength. He needs to demonstrate strength during the debate, that he's going to lead America with strength. No more Roomba presidents. We got a strong fighter back in the White House.
Yeah, that's what he ran on in 2016, and we wanted that strength. And I think that's very well said, Jeff. And I hope that President Trump is listening and takes your advice. So thanks so much. We'll see. With the debate, we'll have analysis tomorrow morning. You can always reach me and my team at jenna@afr.net. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.